My name is Kelly Thompson. I'm a burn surgeon at Vanderbilt, and I'm going to just do a quick introduction of everyone on our panel, and they're going to come up and give their presentations, and we'll ask that you hold all questions till the end, and we'll have a little bit of time at the end for your questions. So we're going to have several speakers this morning. Dr. Nicole Gibran, who is, as she told me, a recovering burn surgeon and a professor of surgery at the University of Washington and Harborview Medical Center, is going to talk to us about episodic burn injuries as a chronic condition. Dr. Seshwati Roy is a professor of surgery and the director of the Clinical Research Center in the Comprehensive Wound Center at Indiana University, is going to speak with us about anatomic differences in burn scarring, discussing in particular a porcine model. Dr. Asim Ejaz is assistant professor of plastic surgery at the University of Pittsburgh. He's going to be speaking to us about a molecular basis of adipose-derived stem cell therapy for radiation burns. Radiation scars, excuse me. Dr. Ben Levy is the director of the Burn and Wound and Regenerative Medicine Laboratory and associate burn director at the University of Michigan, and he's going to talk about fat grafting for burns. And then Dr. Jonathan Friedstadt, who's an acute burn and reconstructive plastic surgeon here in Boston at MGH, is going to talk with us about laser treatment of burn hypertrophic scars. And Dr. Gordillo is my co-moderator, and she will field the questions towards the end. Dr. Gibran.
Callie Gale, thank you very much for including me on this great panel. I am not going to talk about scarring per se, but I am going to discuss the issue of long-term outcomes after burn injuries, of which hypertrophic scarring is, of course, the most visible and a very problematic issue, but I want you to take a high—I want to take a high-level viewpoint to start out with, and sort of frame the issue. My only disclosure is that some of the work that I'm going to present today has been funded by the National Institute of Disability, Independent Living, and Rehabilitation Research. So, why is it important for us to focus on long-term outcomes? Burn surgeons, more than anyone, I think, have done a pretty good job at following our patients long term. And I think most of us who consider ourselves to be burn providers would say that the average amount of time that we should be following a patient with a significant burn is about a year. But I was, this issue of our need to study our patients for longer and engage with them for longer has been building for me for the last few years, and it culminated about a year and a half ago when I was at our M&M's conference, and one of the surgery residents presented a complication in a child, 5-year-old child stabbed by her uncle in a rural part of the state of Washington. And they did a nice job caring for the child locally. They did an exploratory lap. They repaired her. They transferred to us at Harborview for definitive care. She got a wound infection, which is why she was being presented. But the resident then said something which really bothered me. She was discharged PRN. Now, where is the wraparound care for that child who is in what is likely an immigrant situation, non-English speaking, probably not sophisticated with healthcare problems, and is being discharged to an environment where somebody who is supposed to be a trusted part of her family is the one who perpetrated the stabbing? And I think that that becomes a problem for our healthcare system. And so often I talk about the need for us to have medical homes, not for diabetes or for cardiac disease, but for patients who have sustained an episode of trauma or burns. So I think that over the last 30 years, we have made incredible strides in improving mortality after burn injury, and that means that there's an increased number of patients ultimately living who have had a severe burn injury. And that means that the field of burn care has transformed. I think anybody who takes care of burns realizes that most of our care is an outpatient service now, and we're dealing with scars, we're dealing with psychological issues, and I want to share a little bit about that today. So, yes, time does heal most burns. This is the same child that I just showed you, and she's got pretty good scarring. Her donor sites look pretty good, but her issues are going to continue as she ages, both physically and mentally. So I want to start with just a couple of observations. We all know about resuscitation. Anytime you get a burn talk, the thing we like to talk about is resuscitation. It's easy. We talk about failed resuscitations with increased fluid and increased edema causing pulmonary edema associated with ARDS, converting the burns to full thickness injuries if they were partial thickness. We talk about compartment syndromes. We talk about orbital compartment syndrome, which was described about 10 years ago. But how many of us ever ask our patient in the outpatient arena? We may ask them about how their scars are look. Oh, you're healing well. How many of us ever ask their patient, how's your eyesight? We know that with the intraorbital hypertension, they're at risk for optic nerve degeneration, but I would wager that none of us do this in a reliable manner. What about inhalation injury? We focus on the acute diagnosis of it. We focus on now giving everybody who is in a closed space fire, giving them the cyano kit. We try to develop means of staging inhalation injury, grading it so that we can better predict who's going to develop ARDS. But in fact, when we looked at some data from the National Institute of Independent Living Disability and Rehabilitation Research, it turns out that patients who had an inhalation injury 12 and 24 months report a significantly lower quality of life based on SF-12 interviews and surveys than patients who didn't have an inhalation injury. How many of us, when the patient comes back to our clinic, actually query them about how's your breathing? Are PFTs a routine part of our post-discharge plan? I think in an ideal world, every patient who had an inhalation injury might actually get a set of PFTs at 6 months or 9 months after their injury. So, specifically to hypertrophic scar, you're going to hear more about it. I think one of the big problems is that we really don't understand its incidence. We don't have a good feeling for when it develops, who's at risk, even after many years of studying it and actually finally having a few animal models which might represent phenomenology or they might actually represent something that's similar to hypertrophic scarring. We still don't really understand it. We do know, and I'm going to talk a little bit about this, that they tend to be warm, and they tend to have neuropathy. And so variable nerve ingrowth into these wounds leads to decreased sensation in skin grafts, maybe debilitating hyperalgesia with hypertrophic scars, leading to profound itching, wound breakdown as a result of it, which leads to sleep loss, which leads to PTSD, which leads to inability to return to work or school. I have become a huge fan of focus groups and listening to the voice of our patients. And here are some comments that some patients have reported. And I'm just going to focus on the one at the bottom right. And this was a survey response from one of our patients at the University of Washington. Itching, I was burned over 32 years ago. Itching is an ongoing daily reality, thermal regulation or lack thereof, and lifetime physical limitations. So what about itching? When we looked at our burn model system data, in fact, between 4 and 10 years after injury, 40% of our patients are still complaining of itching. About a quarter of them say that they have itching for more than 6 hours a day, and over half of them say that it disrupts their quality of sleep, which ultimately means that they are less able to function during the day, and that equals basically interference with life. So if you're interested in itching, this is a really elegant summation of different types of itch. It was published in 2003. It's not specific to burns, but the team outlines four categories. There's pruritogenic itching, which arises locally in the skin, you know, mast cell derived. There's neuropathic itch, which involves afferent nerve pathology. There's neurogenic, which is central but doesn't involve the local nerve fibers directly. And then there's psychogenic. And so if we were able to develop some systems to be able to treat each of those types of itching, we might actually be able to better intervene on our patients. I think most of us view burn itch to be mostly pruritogenic, and therefore we are a little bit naive in developing options. If you look at options in 2018, you can see that we really haven't made much progress from what we were using 20 years ago. Finally, if you think about the psychological manifestations of unrelenting itching, which is interfering with your life, and you think about the mental stress that that has, look at these data. When we queried patients in the same database 5 and 10 years after injury, about 20% of our patients report depression. Is it because they have issues with body image? Is it because of the itching, which prevents them from sleeping? It's hard to know. But if you compare that to national averages, which are 6% in males and 10% in females, this is a problem that we need to consider when we are caring for our patients. And we should probably be reaching out to our patients longer than the 1 year time frame that most of us choose to follow them. So I'd like to conclude that burn injuries represent a chronic condition, and just as the NASEM report suggested that we have to aim for zero preventable deaths after injury, I'd like to say we should aim for zero preventable disabilities after injury. I want to encourage anybody who's interested in long-term outcomes after burn injuries to share our data. We are very excited about the option for people to use our database. You can look up the operating procedure for how you can access the data, and we are really encouraging people to use the data that we have been collecting since 1993. With that, I thank you for your attention and look forward to some more specific scar talks.
So good afternoon. I'm Sashwati Roy from Indiana University, and thank you for including me in this esteemed panel. Today, my task here is to highlight the differences, anatomic differences, and how that can result in very different type of scarring response. So in this case, we are very interested in facial trauma, and try to understand why the face has very different type of contracture response as compared to any other body parts. So if you look at the face, it has quite a unique features in terms of underlying muscles or microcirculation, and very importantly, it has cranial nerves that supply it, which has a very different regeneration capability compared to peripheral nerve that supply in other regions. So these are the keeping these unique features in mind, we know all of you who are burn surgeons here and deal with this kind of trauma on a daily basis, know that the face has a lot of contractures that it shows, very severe contractures, and that's life-changing experiences for the patient. Quality of life goes down severely. And then also, another major thing that you notice with the facial burn trauma is ectropion. If the eye, mucocutaneous junction of the eyes are involved, you see ectropion. Then you also see eversion of the lips. So mucocutaneous junctions heal very differently in the scarring response. And that's something we are very interested to understand. So one of the challenges when we were approached by Department of Defense to look at facial burn trauma model and come up with some sort of understanding of underlying mechanism, the challenge was, what is the model that we can study? So we came up with a preclinical porcine model where we have now introduced, this is one of the first facial burn trauma model, large animal. And here what we do is we do severe burn, which is all up to the fourth degree. But the thing here is that within a week, the pig is able to eat and it's functioning properly. So even though it's a very severe model, almost like 40% of the face is involved in this burn trauma, but pig is doing perfectly fine in this case. So that's why we could do this, and we could go through the animal protocol people and could get the approval of this model. What you notice is that by day 84, you see these very prominent features of ectropion and also these raised scars. And just for everybody to know that white pigs do not usually show raised scar response. It is the hypertrophic scar that most of the time the other pigs that are the red Duroc pigs that shows the raised scar response. But here you are seeing very prominent raised scars responses. You see the involvement of the bone, so it's a fourth degree burn. So that was the model that we could set up, and I cannot go into any more in depth with the burn protocol, but it's a severe burn protocol that can go up to fourth degree. So now the good thing about this model is you can do all kind of fancy non-invasive approaches so that you can optimize that for clinical use. In this case, we are showing you the CT images, very high resolution, and you see that there is perhaps a burn scar for the bone contracture. There's an hourglass defect here, and so on and so forth. So you not only are seeing that, but we could then do a CT imaging, and this is high resolution CT imaging, where you can now see, and soon you will start seeing that, you can really very in depth, you can see the nerve and also the injury to the blood vessels. So these are the pluses of using a large animal model, that you can use standard clinical approaches to follow this model over a period of time to understand what's going on here. So this is what you can see, and you can see the high resolution of the images, where you're very clearly seeing the non-burn side has a lot of blood vessels, while the other side, and I don't know why it's shaking, but nonetheless, so you got the point here. So the other thing that we were trying to do, as I said, we are very interested to understand what's happening at the mucocutaneous junctions. Why do they heal very differently as compared to any other scar region? So that's the anatomic thing that I was talking to you. So here, what we did is we took biopsies from the junctions. So in this case, eye or lips or just a regular scar region. And when you're looking at the epithelium, you see these fenestrated epithelium in the ectropion region of the eye, and very, very typical of this fenestrated epithelium. We don't know the reason for it, and we are right now looking into it. And then in the lip region, you see these extended retinal ridges and very abnormal type of epithelialization response. Whereas in scar, you can see this hyperproliferation, which is very typical of a scar area. So what we did then, this is currently the studies are ongoing, is that we can go now to the epithelium from all these regions, and we can capture the epithelium using a technique called laser capture microdissection, where you can under the microscope go and capture very specific anatomic areas to the precision of a microscopy. So here you are capturing these epithelium, and you're looking now at, and then we are performing RNA-seq analysis on them and all kind of other omics analysis to understand what's the difference between a regular scar when it's on a skin versus these mucocutaneous junctions. And hopefully at some future time, I'm able to share with you what the responses or results are from the studies. So the first, one of the other things that we did with this is to look at standard inflammation response and angiogenic responses. So when you're looking at the scar, you see that these are MPO, meaning we are looking at the neutrophils here. And when you're looking at the scar versus eye versus lip, so this is the panel for the lips, this is the panel for the eyes, and then you're looking at the scars. So what was very noticeable is that lip, the eye, which is ectropion, shows a huge number of macrophages, which is like very different compared to the scar or the eye. And this, again, is subjected right now for our studies to understand why do you get this kind of huge macrophage infiltration response in the eye area. And does it has anything to do with the ectropion response that you get? The second thing that was noticeable is that the angiogenesis was very high also at the eye area. So the other task that we had with this model was, can you do grafting on it? Because if we are claiming there's a preclinical model, we should be able to do grafting, which is a standard intervention for this kind of trauma. So now with the burn surgeons and with plastic surgeons in the group, one of them sitting here, Dr. Gordillo, we were able to do successfully grafting to these pigs. These are full thickness grafts on the pig, and there are two cases here shown, and they were successful. We followed them up to day 84, and they looked pretty good in this case. You can see the difference in ectropion here. These are the two cases where there was no grafting done, and these are the ones where grafting was done. So yes, there was good response, which is what you expect with the grafting. But then when you're looking at histology, do you see that also in the histological analysis? And very, very clearly what you're seeing is inflammation goes down following grafting, and you have nice blood vessel response, meaning the perfusion comes back with this full thickness graft. So the area was nicely perfused after the grafting. And what happens to the eye and lip region? So we are seeing the inflammation was down at the eye and lip region, which is reaching statistically significance. And so this was this shows you that the model is clinically relevant, first of all. Second is that, yes, you can do histopathology, you can see the differences. Third is that you can do a standard intervention like a full thickness grafting to this model. Finally, we wanted to also do some non-invasive approaches to figure out, can you look at the burn depth? Can you now figure out whether there's a burn conversion happening or not? So for that, what we did is we used an ultrasound harmonic, third harmonic imaging analysis. And using that, we can very clearly measure the burn depths in this case. So here you're looking at the second pass, we see a very clear improvement in the burn depth with the grafting. And these studies are ongoing at this time. So what we think is we have now a non-invasive approach where you can take it to the clinic and you can perhaps start looking at patients that are coming with the different type of burn depths and maybe understand what sort of degree or depth of burn they have. So with that, I would like to conclude this talk. We could set up a large animal model, which is like a fourth degree, and it involves mucocutaneous junctions, which is very characteristic of human burn. Then we also could show that with using non-invasive imaging techniques such as HUSD, which is the harmonic ultrasound-based techniques, or CT scan-based techniques, you can look at the burn injury, like involvement of the blood vessels, nerves, or you can also look at the burn depths. Also, you can do different interventions which are clinically relevant. You can test that intervention such as grafting or other if you are developing any other modalities to treat facial burn. You can test it in this model. You can use this model to start finally understanding what are the differences in anatomic differences and the responses of the burn injury. And finally, you can use this model to perhaps now look at the bone and soft tissue reconstruction. And this study was supported by Department of Defense. Thank you so much for your attention.
Good afternoon. My name is Azim Ejaz, and I'm from the Department of Plastic Surgery, University of Pittsburgh. I thank the committee for giving me the chance to be part of this prestigious panel and present our data. So one of the interests of our lab is to understand the molecular mechanism which is involved in adipose-derived or fat-based therapies for the management of radiation-induced fibrosis. I have nothing to disclose. So radiation therapies, it remains still the cornerstone of modern cancer management, with approximately 50% of all the newly diagnosed cancer patients, they go through radiation therapy at some stage of their disease management. In spite of having a very high success rate, radiation therapies, they are associated with late side effects, and one of the main side effects is in the form of radiation-induced fibrosis. So it is a complex tissue response which is characterized by excessive proliferation of the fibroblast and ultimately result in a massive deposition of extracellular matrix at the site of the injury. So it can cause both cosmetic and functional impairment, which can lead to either death or a significant deterioration in the quality of the life. Clinically, radiation-induced fibrosis, it is manifested in the form of skin induration and thickening of at the injury site, muscle shortening, limited joint mobility, mucosal fibrosis, ulceration, and pain. Mechanistically speaking, the early phase of fibrogenesis can be considered as the normal early phase of the normal wound healing. So what happens is that the acute phase, there is a lot of inflammatory cytokines released, which leads to cell migration at the site of the injury, and mostly immune cells. And these immune cells, they are then responsible for maintaining a very critical balance of the profibrotic and antifibrotic proteins. But what happens in case of radiation injury, that there is a massive production of TGF-beta, which is complemented by DNA damage and radiation-induced fibrosis. And these three things, then it results to a perpetual cytokine cascade. So there is a continuous release of the cytokines, which then ultimately is responsible for the excessive extracellular matrix deposition. So currently, there are very few mitigation options and with a moderate success rate. In the near past, stem cell therapies and mainly the fat or adipose-derived stem cell therapies has shown success in the clinic. And the first clinical evidence was presented by Dr. Ricotti in 2005, and where he showed that using fat and adipose-derived stem cells, he can, after four treatments, you can see this radionecrotic region has been sealed. And he showed a significant improvement in the lint soma score of this cohort of 20 patients. So after this paper, there is a huge influx in the field, and a lot of clinics now are using fat or fat-based products for treating breast cancer radiation injuries at the breast area and the head and neck cancers. But how exactly these adipose-derived stem cells they cure or mitigate the process is not known. So this brings us to answer this question, and to answer this question, we actually have established a mouse model of radiation-induced fibrosis. And using a single dose of 35 gray focused radiation, we observed on the hind limb area a visible constriction of the soft tissue. And you can see that there is a massive collagen deposition at the site of the injury. This was tested with the Mason trichrome staining. To confirm the establishment of fibrosis in our mouse model at a molecular level, we look for the expression of profibrotic genes. And you can see that already at day one post-radiation, there is a massive increase in the expression of this profibrotic genes, mainly TGF-beta, CTGF, and all the collagen protein. And at day 14, we observed a several hundred folds increase in the expression of these genes. So it is known in the field that TGF-beta plays a very important role in the radiation fibrinogenesis, and for many tissues it has been shown. So how actually it works, that TGF-beta is actually present in the tissues, fluid, and in the circulation in a latent inactive form. So what happens that after radiation exposure, this TGF-beta, it is cleaved from its latent associated protein and become active, and it binds to its receptors. And then it activates a signaling cascade via the SMAD signaling pathway, which leads to a transcription of several factors, which are then responsible for the transdifferentiation of fibroblast into myofibroblast, which are further responsible for this extracellular matrix production. To analyze whether this holds true for our mouse model of skin fibrosis, we employed SMAD3 knockout mice. So these mice, they lack the TGF-beta signaling pathway. And as a functional analysis, we used the degree of the motion of the limb as a readout. So here you can see that at day 28 post-radiation, we saw a significant decrease in the motion of the limb, of the hind limb, both in our wild type and SMAD3 knockout mice. But when we keep on observing, and at day 42, we observed that the SMAD3 knockout mice, they recovered, and they never established, or they never went into the chronic fibrosis stage. So it indicates that TGF-beta is indeed actually a main player also in the development of skin fibrosis. Then we tested the efficacy of adipose-derived stem cell in our mouse model and to look at their mitigation property. And a single injection of 1 million adipose-derived stem cells, it leads to a significant recovery of the limb motion by day 49. So the cells were injected at day 28, and already at day 49, we observed a recovery in these mice. We were also able to confirm this recovery at a histological level. So this is saline-treated mice, and you can see a massive deposition and thickening of the epithelium, while in our ASC-treated group, we saw a nice recovery, and the epithelium was comparable to the control group, or non-radiated group. So next we ask, what is the fate of these ASCs which we injected in the, so whether they go into the circulation, go to the bone marrow, asking for some help. And what we did is that we used GFP-labeled ASCs. So these are the ASCs which were isolated from GFP-expressing mice. And they were injected in both irradiated and non-irradiated legs. And you can see that these ASCs, they are captured in the irradiated areas, because in the contralateral non-irradiated legs, these cells are washed away. So it indicates that there is a kind of a microenvironment interaction which holds the cells at the site of the injury. And further, we confirm these cells, the GFP expression, by ex-transplanting this tissue and making a single cell suspension and confirming the GFP expression. So next, the question was, okay, what is released? What are the possible factors which are released by the ASCs which are involved in this mitigation process? So we set up a transferal co-culture in vitro assay. So what we did is that this assay has the irradiated human foreskin fibroblast in the lower part, and the ASCs in the upper part. And these two cells, they can only talk to each other in a paracrine fashion. So we saw a significant increase in the expression of profibrotic genes in this irradiated fibroblast. But upon co-culture with this ASCs, this gene expression, it normalized to the non-irradiated level. So it indicates that there are some paracrine factors released by the ASCs which sense the injury in the fibroblast, and these factors, they shut down the profibrotic genes. So we also confirmed the same findings in a mouse model, and using a in our co-culture system, the stromal cells, bone marrow stromal cells irradiated in the lower part, and ASCs from mouse, and we observed, we were able to reconfirm our finding also in a mouse system. So hepatocyte growth factor, HGF, it has been shown that it plays a yin-yang role with the TGF beta, and it's involved in the recovery, or in the it has a therapeutic effect against fibrosis. So here you can see that in the acute phase, how these two factors, they interact with each other. So there is a insurgent or increased expression of HGF in the acute phase, but during the fibrogenesis phase, the HGF, it goes down, and TGF beta, it takes up, and this leads to development of fibrosis. So here it shows the imbalance between the two. And if we have a therapeutic intervention which can maintain this balance, we have a cure. So looking for the factors which most probably are involved or secreted by the ASCs, we screened the supernatant of our transfer cultures for approximately all the known factors which are released by the ASCs. And what we found is a significant upregulation in HGF level in this supernatants when the ASCs are co-cultured with irradiated fibroblast. So we thought, okay, this is the factor, and to really be sure, then we added recombinant HGF to the irradiated fibroblast, and we can see that a dose-dependent decrease in the expression of TGF beta. So it indicates that ASCs, they excrete hepatocyte growth factor, which is responsible for the downregulation of profibrotic genes. HGF has shown to be perform different roles as a growth factor, as a cytokine, as a chemokine, and we are really interested into its chemokine role. And there are different studies which have shown that HGF, it actually recruit the bone marrow cells at the site of the injury. So based on this data, then we asked the question, okay, whether our ASCs or the HGF released by our ASCs, which we presume yes, are they also able to recruit the bone marrow cells at the site of the injury? So for this, we generated a bone marrow chimeric, GFP bone marrow chimeric mice. So these mice, BLAC6 mice, they have a bone marrow which is from a GFP mice. So, and we radiated this mice and injected ASCs. And you can see here that after day 21 post-radiation, the bone marrow cells in the ASCs injected group, they migrated to the site of the injury, but not all in the saline injected group. We look for the phenotype of the cells which migrated from the bone marrow, and we found that most of these cells are CD34, CD45 expressing cells, CD140, CD31, and SCA1 expressing cells. So these are the cells which migrated from the bone marrow. We are also testing the use of this ASCs across the MHC mismatch. And for this, we are currently testing the ASCs from BLAC6 mice into C3H. This is a complete MHC mismatch mice. And until now, we are able to observe the presence of these cells until day 50 into these mice. So this can be a possible therapy across the different classes of MHC. So to summarize my data, what we can say that ionizing radiation, they leads to a upregulation of profibrotic genes in the skin or muscle of the irradiated mice. And the ASCs injected into the irradiated area, they leads to production of HGF-beta, which works in two different ways. First, it directly blocks the expression of profibrotic genes to stop the further aggravation of the fibrosis. And secondly, it recruits, it acts as a chemokine and recruits the bone marrow cells to perform the repair. With this, I want to thank my group fellows and also our collaborators at the Radiation Oncology Department, University of Pittsburgh. Thank you.
All right. First of all, I wanted to thank the panel for allowing me to be part of this. Dr. Gordillo, Dr. Friedstadt, Dr. Gibran are three of the smartest people that I know in burn surgery and plastic surgery that I try to be like and learn from from a research and clinical standpoint. So today I was asked to talk about fat grafting for burns, and I'm going to make the case that this is a good technique, but there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, and this is not stem cell surgery, despite what some people will claim. I have no disclosures relevant to this. So there's a nice study that Dr. Haltman wrote in the Clinics of Plastic Surgery this year on fat grafting for burn, traumatic, and surgical scars. And the first figure he shows is just that the interest in fat grafting has gone up tremendously. So this is when I was in the lab initially in like 2009, not many people were studying fat, and this has really exploded into recent years. Because of its use in other areas, not just burns, but also in breast reconstruction. So we wrote a review back in 2013 looking at the kind of current state and future directions for fat grafting for thermal injury. And at the time, what was thought to be the mechanism that was going on that when we're putting fat grafting into a burn injury site is that they're having this paracrine effect. So they're secreting cytokines, as our previous presenters have shown, that stimulates angiogenesis. Perhaps that some of the cells there were differentiating into adipocytes, immunomodulation. A lot of studies around fat grafting and also around ASCs have been focused on using this for immunomodulation, including in inhalation injury patients, the antifibrotic effect, which you just heard about, and then potentially skin regeneration. So, when we talk about fat grafting for burns, there's obviously acute, and then there's the reconstructive option. So the acute patients, it can be used to blunt inflammation, promote neovascularization, perhaps improve wound coverage, and reduce infection. Now, there aren't many studies, again, looking at using of fat grafts, and I'll go through some of the studies that are out there and some of their limitations. Where it's used more commonly is really in the chronic setting, so patients that have burn contractures, and we are using it to basically modulate this fibroblast activity and soften scars and improve the contour of a burn scar. So when I started the lab, I was interested in studying fat stem cells and fat grafting specifically. And this was before I was studying a lot of extremity trauma. And the question I asked was, was fat grafting by itself having an effect? Did you have to have adipose-derived stem cells there? Putting them together make it better? And so what we showed here first was just that if you looked at, this is a cell death stain, so tunnel stain, the amount of tunnel stain in those mice that had a burn injury, so this is basically a 40% burn on their back. They tend to scab in full thickness, but eventually they do scab and it will heal up in about 14 to 21 days. In those that were treated with fat plus ASCs, they had less cell death that we saw. And you can see in general that their scars looked better at 14 days compared to controls. We then looked at the amount of the depth of the burn when we treated a burn with either fat, ASCs alone, or fat plus ASCs. Again, improvement in the burn depth. this is statistically significant, but you know, not a substantial real difference in the depth of the burn that we're seeing. So again, you know, this is more fat grafting for acute burns, which I still think is not necessarily something that I have in my practice. There was a study that was looking at this fat grafting in burn patients, and so what they did is they took biopsies of patients 6 months after their fat grafting and at the time of their initial surgery, and this is an H&E stain, and you can see that there's less fibrosis 6 months out. Now again, scars will get better on their own as well, so it's hard to know with any of these studies that we show. And this was a P53 stain, so there was more cell proliferation in those scars that were treated with fat grafting. So then when I started out, Dr. Sederna, Dr. Sidney Coleman, and Peter Rubin wanted to summarize the current state of fat grafting and to look at what are the different techniques that are out there. And so what we did is we looked back in this paper in PRS to see there are a huge amount of variables that you could do when you're doing fat grafting. And so these are kind of the top eight variables that we went through. And I'm going to go through these because I think they're important. So the first one was looking at where you harvest from, right? So where should we be getting the fat from when we're doing fat grafting? And the study by Dr. Rourke in 2004 basically showed there was no difference if you got from the abdomen, from the thigh, from the knee, or wherever you harvested your fat from. There was then a study in 2008 that said that perhaps there's more viable cells if they collected from the lower abdomen than the thigh or the knee. Again, this was an in vitro study. You know, personally, when I'm taking care of patients, I usually ask them to choose where they want the fat harvested from. So I don't know that the depot actually makes a huge difference when I'm doing fat grafting. Then tumescence. So there's lots of different tumescent fluids out there, and this is tumescence is a fluid that we inject at the time to harvest grafts to make it easier to do the liposuction and to decrease bleeding. And basically, a study by Dr. Moore in 1995 showed no difference with their different tumescent techniques. Another one that used different levels of bupivacaine, lidocaine, said that perhaps using these local anesthetics did improve the viability compared to just not using their tumescent solution. And then the third study in 2012 showed that adipocytes from the lidocaine and epinephrine treated had greater surface area and viability compared to a dry technique. So, perhaps tumescence in these cases were somewhat useful. In my practice, typically what I'll do is I'll harvest the fat first and then I'll inject the tumescence afterwards because I don't want to affect the cells that I'm harvesting at the time. One of the things that I think was very clear, one of the variables was ultrasound, using ultrasound to harvest fat. So ultrasound-assisted liposuction became a big thing about 10 years ago, and it is very effective to help kind of break up fat to do liposuction, especially big volume liposuction. But if you actually want that fat to survive and you're using it for fat grafting, it's probably not a good idea. Dr. Rourke showed that it caused 70-90% damage to the adipocytes, so I don't use ultrasound when doing fat grafting procedures for burn patients. What about cannula size? So it's another thing that you can alter in your practice. A couple studies showed basically that bigger cannula size may improve viability, the idea being that you're not breaking up the adipocytes as much. And the study in 2009 showed that 6 millimeter cannula result in the greatest adipocyte viability. Then there were some studies that looked at a 3 millimeter versus a 3 millimeter with multi-perforations. The perforations did not seem to have an effect. So I typically will use a large bore cannula when doing my liposuction harvest for fat grafting. Centrifugation is also a big thing that you can change up. Lots of people use different settings for their centrifuge. As Dr. Rourke looked at this, showed that centrifugation reduced cell proliferation. They used 500 Gs for 2 minutes. Another study showed that centrifugation and washing reduced the cell number and nucleated adipocytes. And then a couple more studies in 2010, 2011 showed that the one in 2010 showed the centrifuge above 500 RPMs did result in damage to the structural integrity of the adipocytes, whereas a follow-up study showed that there were no difference in viable cells except if you got really high on your RPMs. And I typically will do 3,000 RPMs for 3 minutes is the standard that we've done at our institution. Then where you get the fat from, so like when you have your liposuction harvest, you have different layers. So the lower layer of basically yields the greatest density of viable cells, and so that's where you have your SVF, and that's where you get your adipose-derived stem cells from. And so when you have your fat grafting, after you spun it down, what you have your low density fat and your high density fat. And also in there, that usually the stuff that when you drain out, and I'll show a photo here in a minute, you know, you have your other immune cells and red cells. The last thing that they looked at was injection speed. So how fast you're injecting it. If you Coleman techniques in general use these small syringes, so that will slow down the speed that that you're injecting with. And they found that slow injection resulted in larger xenografts, whereas faster injection led to more collagen deposition and immune cell infiltration, which makes sense. If you're kind of creating more inflammation, you might get a more robust inflammatory response. This is the paper I showed you at first from Dr. Holtman's group. And so this just, I think, shows that we really don't have great data on fat grafting for burns. So the best studies that are out there were these three, two prospective control studies, and then a randomized control that was only 7 patients. So these were level 3 and level 4 data. So, you know, really we need people out there to study this in a rigorous manner, like some of the people who presented today, to understand what is the effect that we're having. Is it better than, you know, just giving the scar time, using it with laser, does that add a benefit to our results? This is a nice picture that Dr. Holtman used as well. I think it's important is that when you're doing fat grafting, you want to make sure you're injecting in multiple planes. If you're not in multiple planes, and you just stack fat up on top of fat, oftentimes the grafts will not survive. This is one of the more difficult things with burns, because burns in general, the tissue, you often don't have that large tissue envelope like you might for some of the breast reconstruction patients. So it's hard to get those multiple layers of fat grafting. So it does often require multiple rounds of treatment. So this is some results that Dr. Holtman showed with fat grafting plus laser. You can see here, obviously, prior to treatment and post-treatment, a pretty dramatic improvement in the results. Of course, it's hard to know, would he have gotten the same results just with laser treatment alone? This is another nice result he showed after 2 sessions of fat grafting of 18 mLs plus laser resurfacing, again, before and after. Again, hard to know, when Dr. Friesack shows some of his laser results, you'll see that sometimes laser alone also has this type of effect. Here's some cases that I've done that were, you know, laser only. So pulse dye and CO2, you can see that you get a pretty dramatic effect, you know, even without, I didn't do any fat grafting in this case. This gentleman here as well, after 1 round of CO2 and pulse dye laser, that you can get a nice effect. I did not do any fat grafting for these patients. So again, you know, trying to understand when to use fat grafting with laser or one alone, I think is important. So my kind of non-data driven indications, and I say non-data driven because I think the data out there just isn't what we hope. So I wait for burn scars to mature at least 6 months. I don't use it in a just a normal burn scar. There really has to be a soft tissue deficit that's there. And I'll show results from this patient. It was a patient that was basically dragged under a car for a mile after getting hit on Halloween, basically taking down a large area of her gluteal tissue. And so you can see she's missing tissue. So for that type of a burn patient, it is useful. A patient has to have adequate adipose stores. They have to be willing to undergo multiple procedures. And I try to do it at the same time that I'm doing a laser or some other release, so I'm not just doing fat grafting when we go to the operating room. So based on kind of that table I showed you, these are the things that I do. So the harvest site, again, I ask the patient what they prefer, and oftentimes it ends up being the thigh or the abdomen. I don't use ultrasound to harvest it. I use tumescence, but I inject it after I've harvested my fat. I use big cannula size. I centrifuge for 3,300 RPMs for 3 minutes. And then my injection speed, you know, I don't necessarily have a stopwatch there to know how fast I'm injecting it, but I try to be mindful of that. So I think in general, doing big harvests and big grafts is important because you lose, even in the best of hands, you know, 50 to 60% of the fat will not be there at 6 months. So in order for me to be able to do that, you know, some of the staff I work with will, you know, basically just use a 60cc syringe and a hand suction, and that really, I'm not patient enough and strong enough to do that for a long period of time. So I basically get a big liposuction cannula, I hook it up to a suction device, and then I have these test tubes that are hooked up with suction tubing, and so each of these holds about 10 to 20 cc's of fat, and so then I can harvest all this fat at once, and then I could centrifuge all that fat, and then I have all of my tubes that I've centrifuged. I pour out the fat from the top, and then I drain it from the blood from the bottom, And then what I do is I take all that fat that's spun down, I put a 60C syringe to a smaller syringe here for my injection. And so again, it saves steps, because if you're in the operating room doing a bunch of different things, laser, fat grafting, you want to be efficient with your time. So this is a way with that tubing and with these, you know, taking all the fat at once and then injecting it with small syringe allows me to be efficient in that regard. So this was that patient I showed you. We just did one round of 200 cc's of fat from her, and I'm trying to get her back to do another round. But you could see that, you know, it was the scar in general was very flat, kind of missing volume. And we are able to improve some of that volume. And the scar texture looks better. We did also laser her. So again, it's hard to know what the fat is having effect. But for volume filling, I think it is very useful. I also wanted to show some other cases from my colleagues. Christian Verkler, who's also will see pediatric patients. So this patient had a radiation burn in the gluteal region. You can see after the fat grafting, 3 months out, and then at 6 months out. So you do lose some of the fat, but in general, pretty robust response from large volume fat grafting. Dr. Kasten's case here, this is a dog bite, which I think had a lot of similar qualities to a hypertrophic burn scar. You can see on the lip. And this is after just a round of fat grafting. This patient did not get laser. And you can see that scar has remodeled and it fills in that kind of defect that was there. This was a case of Dr. Sederna's. And again, I tried to show kind of different surgeons that do it. That way I'm not just, you know, cherry picking my own cases. This was after fat grafting from a flame burn. And you can see here a pretty nice improvement in the scar remodeling. This is another dog bite. And you can see the lack of volume projection of the lip really helps push that lip back out there after treatment. So as I said, you know, if you go online and you type in fat stem cells for fat grafting, you'll get lots of different websites and private practice people that are claiming to do it. And I want to make clear that, you know, when you're doing fat grafting, this is not stem cell surgery. So this was given to me by Jeff Gimbel. He's a researcher at Tulane who also has a company. I don't have any financial interest or anything like that. And they collect adipose-derived stem cells. And so any of us that harvest them, what you know is that when you're getting the fat tissue, the stromal vascular fraction is down here. It's not your fat. It's not the stuff that you're putting in when you're doing fat grafting. And even in 10 cc's of fat, 10 mLs of fat, only 5% of your cells or less are actual adipose-derived stem cells or stromal cells. So it's not really, this is not stem cell surgery that we're doing. The uncultured cells is called the SVF. In order for them to really become ASCs, you have to culture them out. And you know, the idea and the thought is that having this SVF, and some people add SVF back to fat grafting, it will improve differentiation, improve the immune tolerance. Again, a lot of these studies still are pending, and I think more work coming out of some great groups that are studying this will lead us down that road. And so just to show, so a stem cell, right, has to form all three lineages, ectoderm, mesoderm, endoderm, right? So that's an embryonic stem cell or an iPS cell. An ASC is already down the mesodermal lineage and really doesn't, even though people can show it can form all these things in a dish, no one has shown that they will turn into these other tissues in vivo without some type of scaffold, growth factor, something. So really, I think it's important that we're very careful when we're telling our patients what we're doing. This is not stem cell surgery. We're not putting stem cells back in them. This is a tissue-resident cell. If you want to do that, you could transform them back into an iPS cell, but that's a completely different operation, or it's not FDA-approved and not something that we're doing in the clinics. Additionally, the ASCs themselves are heterogeneous, and when we look at this with single-cell RNA analysis, every adipose stem cell is different if you were to look at them. And so this is not a homogeneous population of cells. And so, you know, hopefully down the road we'll understand, are there some that are better to put in a fat graft than others? But again, that work is still in progress. So conclusions, fat grafting surgery is not stem cell surgery. It is a useful tool for burn patients. Indications, I think, are similar to other scars. So if it's a scar that has a contour deficit, it's useful. Isolating and handling the fat may alter the tissue viability and characteristics, and really more rigorous studies in humans are needed to draw conclusions about the mechanism of how fat grafting is having an effect. So I want to thank my colleagues at University of Michigan, those who I was able to talk with them about some of their cases as well. This is the Burn Wound Regeneration Laboratory at Michigan. We have a tremendous diverse group there that have been great to work with and our funding agencies, and again, thank you to the panel for this opportunity.
Okay, so I'm going to try to finish this off here with talking about lasers. First, I'd like to thank the panel for the invitation. Thank you all for your attention. I'm going to try to give you a broad overview of why people have become so optimistic with the use of lasers for burn scars. We'll cover the problem, some of the previous solutions that we've had, how laser works, what the differences are between some of the lasers, some of the data that's available, the gaps in our knowledge, and what the future may hold in store for it. All right, so the problem, I think, is a straightforward one to anybody that knows burns, and even if you don't, looking at these pictures, you see that these patients have fairly significant hypertrophic scars. Whether you look at the kid in the top there, that his neck is essentially attached to his chest, or the other kid on the side where his arm and wrist are misshapen and deformed from the force of the scarring, or even the gentleman whose tattoo, which used to be linear, has been misshapen from the forces of burn scar contracture. All of these patients suffer from hypertrophic scars. Now, they limit function. They can have symptoms, though, that aren't visible. And I think that this is really gets back to what Dr. Gibran was talking about. If you don't ask patients, you actually don't know some of these issues. And they'll come in looking like they have a perfectly normal healed skin graft. And when you start asking them about symptoms like pruritus, neuropathic pain, and hypersensitivity, you can find out how disabling some of these symptoms are for patients. I've had some that can't wear any clothing because the contact between the cotton and their skin is so irritating. I've had others that come in and they want prescriptions for tinted windows for their cars because the heat from the sun going through the glass is so irritating to the skin graft that they have, and they've tried all sorts of other things and can't find a solution. What we've done typically in the past has been surgical in nature. It's been releases and grafts, excising scars and trying to close them. Tissue rearrangements with Z-plasties have been the mainstays of surgical therapy. And you look at all those kids' pictures after surgery, and it's very clear. Like, his neck is no longer where it used to be. It's in an appropriate position. The other kid's arm is back where it's supposed to be. The two young kids on the bottom right there both have faces that have tissue back where it's supposed to be. All right, but surgery alone is not the only way we treat scars. We've tried non-surgical things like compression and silicone, and they have mixed results. And sort of from a personal point of view, one of the things I've struggled with as a burn surgeon, a plastic surgeon, is we want people to go back to doing the things that they did before. We want them to not feel stigmatized by what their burn scars made them look like, that they should be no different than anybody else. And then when we ask them to wear compression garments like that, we're doing the exact opposite. We're drawing attention to them. We're making them be different. And internally, that bothers me. And when you start to actually look at some of the data are very unclear about some of these things that we do. Silicone, maybe, maybe not. There's some data to support it. If you look at the Cochrane review, it would suggest that, but the studies have significant bias and flaws with them. When you look at compression, even the largest one from Harborview with the best long-term follow-up, you get mixed results, typically most with people with very severe burns, but when they looked at it at Iowa, they found no difference. And when you even go down and look at lasers, now granted this was a few years ago when I was still in training, lasers are showing some early promise as a way to try to treat these scars, but we really don't have an effective modality that's evidence-based at a level one form to justify what we do sometimes for these scars. And so I'll transition here to talk about lasers. So what is a laser? Like, not all lasers are the same. People say, oh, I'm going to go get laser treatment. Well, lasers target a specific wavelength and a specific chromophore. And this is important to understand because in burns, we target typically three different categories of things. There's pigment or color, like hemoglobin or melanin, that has a specific wavelength associated with it. We sometimes try to modulate the scar and the collagen either with non-ablative or ablative forms of laser treatment. And sometimes we target the hair follicles that get embedded in the skin grafts or the scar to try to alleviate some of the chronic infections patients get. All right, and each of these techniques, each of these settings is different. So not all lasers are created equal. They each do something different and specific depending on what the symptoms are that the patient has. Really, the paradigm for laser treatment for scar rehabilitation, as Matt Donilon has coined the phrase, began back with Tina Alster in the early 90s when she started using pulse dye laser to show that you could actually change some of the symptoms in burn scars. And I would argue Matt Donilon's work from Shriners in Boston really paved the way to ask the question of, like, you look at these pictures before and after where you have a very obvious hyperemic scar treated with multiple rounds of PDL, or this young girl when she was a kid who got burned on her face who then grew up to be a young adult with very minimal appearing scars. These people were treated with just pulse dye laser. All right, and what I think he and others really did was they laid the foundation for finding ways to treat scars without excising them and doing things surgically to them, that we could actually rehabilitate them and do things in other ways to improve the scars. And really where burn scars and laser treatment took off was probably in about 2009. Rox Anderson, who's a dermatologist at Mass General and probably one of the brightest people I've ever met, he's one of the most creative individuals, designed a fractional blade of CO2 laser that Jill Weibel used to treat three twins. They actually are called the Burns triplets. It's B-E-R-N-S, not like burn, like the injury. And these young girls were burned in a house fire when they were infants. And they had approached Jill Weibel and said, would you be willing to try to treat us? We're desperate to try to improve the scars on our face. And she treated them pro bono with the laser, and they had amazing results. So amazing that they made it on all of the talk shows, all of the morning TV shows, news shows, everywhere. And it raised a level of awareness among our patients that lasers could actually potentially do something to help them. And if you look at the results by year, the highlighted bars in 1999, you see a fairly rapid increase, sort of like a wave taking off on the north shore of Oahu. Like, you see a tremendous increase in the number of publications. And yes, we're getting interested in it. Yes, there's more things out there. But these are some of the historical events that happen behind that data. All right, and what we think the CO2 laser does, the CO2 laser right now is probably one of the more popular used ones, but it's not the only one. And what this laser does is it creates tiny little burn injuries. And this is another question we can get to later if you want to talk about it, but we do burn the burn patient a second time to ablate small columns of tissue that are called these microthermal treatment zones. They're small enough to heal without scarring. But what they do in the process of stimulating thousands of little holes for wound healing is you not only reorganize the collagen that is now stiff in their hypertrophic scar more to a natural and elastic state, but you also generate new collagen. And as you do this repeatedly, you get a repeated effect. All right, and when you look at some of the stuff in the literature, I'm going to give you some of the highlights from our literature and also from the dermatology literature. This was a paper that I worked with Scott on back when I was a resident. It was probably one of the best in terms of long-term data. But what we showed is that patients that got treated with fractional blade of CO2 laser not only had improvements in their Vancouver scar scores, which is a way of assessing changes in the scars, but that these were long-lasting results that could last at least up to 2 years based on the follow-up that we had. When you look at what Dr. Levy and Dr. Governman, my colleague at Mass General, did, they showed that some of those exact symptoms that I was talking to you about, the pain, the tingling, the pruritus, and also the tightness, all of these things got better in at least half or more of their patients. And when you look at these pictures, I'd say, okay, picture in on side A and side B, like if you treat someone with laser, time alone I don't think could do that. All right. Or when you look at this person's arm, would that arm have gotten better all by itself? Maybe, maybe not. I don't know. But when you take a look at the data as a whole, and in this case, what happened here was Rox and several other dermatologists, including Jill Weibel, got together and formed an expert consensus panel that this was later published in JAMA Dermatology to really advocate that laser should become a part of the treatment paradigm for burn patients. So no one paper, I think, in itself is really a landmark paper, but the collective data as a whole suggests that laser works. And if you take a look at some of the more recent ones, like I did a couple days ago, in the dermatology literature, you'll see from like 2015 to 2018, there are several papers that are randomized controlled trials that have split scar study designs that show positive results. One of the problems with most of these, though, is that the sample size is relatively small. So this sort of leads to one of the questions, which maybe we can discuss about later, is the laser really doing something? You know, the plastic surgeon part in me would say, yes, these pictures look like there's a dramatic result. The general surgeon in me would say, well, how can you prove that you don't have data? You know, and what about time? Scars are going to get better with time. So how much of this effect is time? How much of it is treatment? Or is it potentially a combination of the two? You know, in terms of thinking of clinical trials, one of the things that I think is important, and we can discuss it more later if there's interest, is how do you design a good study that's actually going to answer these questions? Most people agree that there has to be some sort of internal control because the variability between two individuals is too high when looking at how they scar. So people either do it through a split scar study where they split the same scar into two portions or more, or they do it finding symmetric scars on both upper arms or lower arms so that you can actually eliminate the variability of individuals. You definitely need to have a power calculation, and there's enough data now to be able to calculate the effect size that you would want to measure when you design your study. And then the assessments and how you figure out, are these things working? You have to look at this from multiple angles. You have to look at it, does the skin get softer? What does it look like? So photography will be important. You can look at histology to understand what goes on within the cells. You can look at gene expression. You can look at patient outcome measures. I think that you need to look at it from multiple vantage points to truly understand if this is beneficial or not. And you also have to follow them for enough time to be able to show that this is meaningful. So I'll conclude here by saying that I think laser may have the potential to be illuminative and transformative for what we do for burn patients. But even if it's not, I think that some of the data and the studies that are in the pipeline will provide the light that we need to know whether or not these things work. Because if it does, for me, what I find most important is that we do the studies not just because we want to know the answers, but also to help our patients. And it's not just to help them by getting the answer, but with good data, you publish those things, you get them out into the literature, you get them to insurance companies, it makes it harder for people to not have access to care. So from the public health part of me, if this does work, improving access through quality data, improving knowledge to other burn centers so that they begin to offer this everywhere is important to our patients. And I think that's ultimately where the direction goes, regardless of what the data shows. So if it works, then great. If it doesn't, then we'll find something else. But we should always keep fighting for our patients. So I'll conclude there. I'm happy to take any questions.
First, I'd like to thank our panelists for a really great series of presentations. And then let's open it up for questions from the audience, please. And if you have a question, please step to the microphone. Any questions? I'm going to start with a question then. Ben, have you ever used the Revolve system for fat graft harvesting?
It's a good question. Actually, one of my colleagues at St. Joe's, which is just down the street, asked me about it because he thought that we were using it. But no one currently at University of Michigan is using it. I don't have access to it, so I'm not sure.
No disclosures, but it's fabulous. I do a lot of fat graftings for breast, and it's really you get the centrifugation, you get a really nice pure fraction. It's a good system.
Right, I'll have to email Paul and CC you.
I mean, for those of you who are thinking about fat grafting, I've done it with the Coleman syringes and I've used a tongue blade. I've used this little prop that you put in there to hold it under suction and the Telfa, and it's just so difficult, but the Revolve system is really quite nice.
I was actually going to ask you that too, Ben. The other one is the lipofilter system too. The best thing about it is it allows you to use a really large cannula, as you were saying, is important. So both those systems can do it quickly, and the isolation is much quicker. And it does involve, so much centrifugation either, so.
That'd be good to look at, thank you.
Hi, I got a couple questions. One is, my radiation oncology buddy tells me he can zap keloid scars and prevent them from coming back. And given that, radiation is driving this TNF-beta or TGF-beta, does that make sense to you? And number two, do lasers work on keloids? Straight keloids, not burn injury, that kind of thing.
That's a pretty standard therapy, and usually they only will treat the keloid like once or twice, so it's not a whole bunch. That's a pretty standard therapy at least for me with keloids. I'll try excision with steroids, and then if they recur with that, because that's about a 50% recurrence. I think the literature is if you do keloids with radiation, you got about an 80% success rate. You got to get them in right, like usually the same day or the next day, into the radiation oncologist. So I don't know that anybody knows the mechanism, but that's...
Electron beam is the one they use more
common. Yeah, that's pretty standard. Yeah, and he said the electron beam, but that's pretty standard.
Do lasers work on keloids?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
So when I started, I was talking with colleagues, they had said that they had used pulse dye successfully for keloids. Now, the challenge with that is that pulse dye targets, as John showed, 585 nanometers or red, chrome, red color, which most people with keloids have dark skin to begin with. If it's Fitzpatrick 5 or 6, I don't find that it's useful. If you have someone that is light skin color and you use pulse dye plus steroid injection, I've seen some improvements. As far as the CO2 laser, when I started out, I was afraid that because the keloid is caused by injury, that by using it, you'd actually make it worse. I have done some areas where I'll do just a test site on someone that has keloids all over their body. And I'd say that it maybe softens a little bit. It certainly doesn't exacerbate the keloid, but I'm not... I still don't think either laser is a great treatment for keloids. I think that maybe it makes it a little bit better, doesn't make it worse, would be what I'd say. I don't know, John, if you have a different...
Yeah, no, I would agree with Ben on that. I think that one of the things we didn't talk about was that the laser is also being used and investigated as a way to deliver therapeutic agents. So commonly what I'll do is use the Kenalog like we would inject into a hypertrophic scar. And if you get into the right plane, you'll actually see the Kenalog shoot out of the laser holes. You can also rub it topically over the top of it. And when the laser creates each one of those little holes, there's a zone of coagulation that's around each conical defect caused by the laser. There's some data that suggests that whatever medication, injectable, topical you put on, that some of them can actually be absorbed into that necrotic tissue. So laser can be a drug delivery device. I haven't used it a ton for keloids, and I share Ben's sort of reservations about it. But I do think that if new therapeutics come online that may be able to be delivered through the laser in and of itself may become a drug delivery system as much as it is a collagen stimulating system.
And one thing, too, to what John and I work a lot together is that with the keloids we inject as well, you know, inject, and then the ablative laser has a deeper setting because the standard deep effect doesn't penetrate deeper at all.
But when you inject the Kenalog, you have to see an effect. Like, every time I do it, it's always kind of, I don't know.
No, if you inject, so in other words, what we'll do is a combination
size
of injection. No, very, very
just
rarely.
Inject.
No, no, no. Inject, use the scar effects on the laser plus in blade setting, and put in medicine topically and do it multiple times.
Does cash pay it something? Does anybody pay for that?
No. And that's the other thing is, you know, eventually us getting laser codes that are not destruction codes that eventually will, I think, help to make this more.
Does anybody have the experience that the Kenalog injections actually result in attenuation of your scar, so you get this very thin, fragile scar that is not that much more attractive than the hypertrophic scar?
Sure.
Yeah, I think I have a series of those, and I could probably show you.
What?
Yeah, I probably have several of those that I've been upset with myself over doing.
I have some as well.
Hi, I'm Robert Ball from Washington Hospital Center. I was wondering if I could just hear from the panel your opinions or differences in timing of introducing laser therapy for scar management.
You're up, Jonathan.
Okay. If we go by the data, I don't think that there's a clear answer. So I'll give you sort of my experiential opinion. Laser, I think, works for people. I think that it works variably, some better than others. And I don't think that there's a perfect time as to when to start. When I first was in training and laser was brand new, we were waiting 6 months to a year. As I've progressed further along, the gauge has moved shorter and shorter. And in some patients that I've treated at Shriners here in Boston, where I have a short time window before their visas expire and they have to go back home, I've treated them as early as 6 weeks afterwards. I've not had any problems with any of those time points in terms of wound healing issues. I just don't have enough good data or experience to provide like long-term follow-up to tell you what I think the right answer is. But I think that any of those time points have worked well for me if the laser is used at a safe setting.
Yeah, I found the same. I typically, when my first year I started, I wouldn't start until at least a year out. Now I usually will see patients back at 6 months, and then it usually takes about a month to get them scheduled or so. So usually 6 to 7 months is when I'm starting. I think the one thing to keep in mind is, actually we studied where we inject the Kenalog, and there, you could actually do a send out lab now where you could see how long the Kenalog hangs around in the blood. And when we did that, the Kenalog will actually hang around in the blood for 9 to 12 months. So if you take a patient back multiple times in a year, you have to be very careful of the amount of, in a big burn, the amount of Kenalog that you're exposing them to, because you can have iatrogenic effects, like a Cushing type effect on them. So I think that's the one thing. So I typically will at least spread out my lasers between them at least, you know, 2 to 3 months. And then if I've done Kenalog before, I will maybe only do laser the second and third time around.
Any other questions? Yes, in the back.
You mean doing almost like a tangential excision with a laser? As a preparation of the wound bed with a laser is what you're speaking of?
In the past, we used to do that one.
Mm-hmm.
So the label sterilization of the surface we have completely eradicating the studies done.
That's not a practice I'm familiar with.
I'm not familiar with that.
Years ago, Dr. David Auth, who developed the gastroscope-guided coagulation device, developed a laser that was being studied at the University of Washington for excision of burn wounds. And it really was demonstrated to be no more efficacious than cold steel. I have a comment in follow-up to the last discussion point about timing for laser. I think that now that I am a recovering burn surgeon, I think that I would encourage the reconstructive rehabilitation surgeons to think outside the box. I think that our historic approach to treating scars has been misguided by the tendency in the past 25 years to wait to see how the scar matured and then make a decision. And many times we put the patient off, maybe because we actually don't have anything to offer them or didn't have anything to offer them. And so we would say, come back to see us in a year, and if your scar is still a problem and time is not healed your wounds, then we will come up with some sort of scar plan. And I think that it's high time that we think outside the box and try to mitigate the scarring and modulate the wound before the scar forms, rather than let this scar form and then have to treat it. I will say that at the other side of successful timing for laser therapy, before we had our laser program in place, I was struggling with a child who had itching that was so excruciating that he constantly had breakdown in his torso wounds. His excoriations were bloody, deep, wide. They were really terrible. And 5 years after his injury, he had one laser therapy, and I happened to walk into the clinic. And I know it's an anecdote, but it tells me that there is hope. He ran up to me and said, no itching, which I think is quite remarkable. So what it says is that it's possible that if laser is going to be effective, just because the patient is 5 years out, doesn't mean that they should not be given a chance at having the therapy.
That's a great point. I think the itching is, for me, the most rewarding effect that we have on laser. Patients that have bad itching to begin, I think, are the most appreciative after you treat them.
Can I ask a question?
Of course.
Regarding the stem cells and regarding the fat grafting, both of you alluded to the paracrine effects of the injectable cells. And I wonder what you can say, especially, Ben, since you showed that layer of apoptotic cells. What can you say about the role not of paracrine molecules, but of microvesicles, apoptotic bodies, or exosomes?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's not something that we've looked at in our laboratory. A colleague of mine at Hopkins, Dr. James, has been studying that specific thing where they'll take the exosomes from ASCs and they have some of the same, he's studying it, using it for bone regeneration, but basically whether you use the ASCs by themselves or the exosomes from the ASCs, he's able to get similar effects of bone regeneration. So I think it's a very interesting area of research that I haven't done it. I'd encourage people to do it. But yeah, I think there probably is something that, you know, in general, if you look, at least when we've even put it from mouse into mouse, that these cells don't really aren't around for very long. I know we saw some studies where they do hang around for a while, but the majority of them are not hanging around. So probably looking at the exosomes, apoptotic bodies, those types of things early on is probably where we're seeing most of the effect.
But what, so you show, in your model,
yeah,
you show this profound layer of apoptotic cells.
Yeah.
What if those dead cells are actually having some sort of function.
Yeah.
Maybe they're not just useless cellular debris. For those of you who don't know what we're talking about, cells actually, it turns out, have little blebs off their membrane, and that's a major way that cells communicate, by blebbing off a piece of cell membrane with some key molecules from the cytoplasm in it, and that's actually how intercellular communication may be occurring, in addition to what we've traditionally known as excrete or secrete a cytokine or a growth factor, and it somehow finds its way to the target cells.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point that needs to be studied. The other area I think really right now is taking off is there was a recent paper by Dr. Leinker's group in Science that looks at the actual, you know, what we call all the cells that form scars fibroblasts. But yeah. there are multiple subpopulations of these cells, and there are subpopulations that are the scar-forming fibroblasts. And so, you know, if we can better understand those specific the heterogeneity within the cells that are forming scar, and perhaps just targeting those cells that are the scar-making cells, that I think also is an area that, you know, in the future would be really important to look at.
Dr. Roy, do you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think I just wanted to also point out that one of our current studies shows that even myeloid cells or the so-called macrophages at a wound-sized site can convert into fibroblasts, or some of them could be the scar-forming, or they could be the ones that are against the scar, so that those studies are ongoing. But the bottom line is immune cells have the capability of converting into fibroblasts is what we are seeing. These are the recent studies.
Well, I think one of the intriguing things is, you know, based on the old work that Brian Nikoloff did at Michigan, where, I mean, what exactly is a fibroblast? And how do you differentiate the quote-unquote fibroblast cells in the dermis from the other immune cells that have the same morphology? They're all spindle-shaped cells, and I mean, we really never have gotten a handle on what a fibroblast is.
That's right. I have a different point of view from the using the exosomes and ASCs, because for me, cell itself is a living machinery, and when it's come to the microenvironment, so it can talk to the microenvironment. And when we speak about using the exosomes itself and just taking them from a normal cells, these exosomes have not been trained to behave in a different microenvironment. While when using the cell itself, it can like upregulate or downregulate or respond to different microenvironments. So it's a different.
One more question from the audience.
Yeah, my name is Zach Brown from Naval Medical Center, Camp Lejeune. I was wondering if any of you had any experience with placenta-derived allografting in treating burns, and whether and what results you've seen from that with a lesser scar formation.
The only area I've used it is for patients with like exposed tendon. For them, I'll use some of the new placental derived off the shelf products to get a granulation tissue to eventually graft. But I haven't used it. I know they're marketing it now for to decrease scars and use it acutely. For that, I haven't used it.
No experience.
Yeah, my only experience with the placental derived products has been in chronic wounds. And it's in situations where I have no other really good option to try to get a wound closed, including free flap. So I haven't used it in burns.
All right. Thank you, everybody. Thank you for coming. Thank you to our panelists.